This podcast is part of a series commissioned by the International Society for Frontotemporal Dementias as a part of the 11th Conference for Frontotemporal Dementias held during November 2018 in Sydney, Australia. In this edition, we speak to Raphael Ferrari, Alzheimer's Society Junior Research Fellow at the University College in London, UK. Dr. Ferrari spoke on the International FTD Genomics Consortium, an international platform to study and understand frontotemporal dementia.
My name is Raf Ferrari, so I'm currently a research associate at UCL, University College London in the UK. I'm a junior fellow funded by Alzheimer's Society, and my research focus is genetics of frontotemporal dementia, but through the years. My major focus is frontotemporal dementia and studying its associated genetics. One of the needs in the field really is that of starting understanding the genetic etiology at the basis of the disease, because it will give us an indication of where to start looking at if we want to understand the mechanism of disease, which is very critical. We want to know what goes wrong in the brain or in the system of in the whole body of an individual that then leads ultimately to frontotemporal dementia. We want to understand what happens within the physiology of an individual to be able to know where we need to go and intervene. And of course, this has a multi-layered goal. One of the goals is that of identify ways to improve early diagnosis of the disorder so that we can even prevent the neurodegenerative pattern to start, and then once it starts, it becomes irreversible. But of course, we know that there are so many people now affected with this disease, although this is a rarer form of dementia. It affects up to between 5 and 15 every 100,000 people. So
I'll just jump in there. So you said that it's a rarer, there are more and more people being diagnosed with it. Is that true, that there are more and more diagnoses?
Well, we have better means now to recognize it, because many of individuals who are now diagnosed as frontotemporal dementia were previously probably categorized as Alzheimer's disease patients, because we really, the major neurodegenerative disorders which are known also to the public, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, say amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is a slightly different, it's not necessarily dementia, is more also motor related, but there is with an increase of the an improvement of the diagnostic criteria, the clinical diagnosis, the pathological diagnosis, the genetic diagnosis, we're able to identify patients better than before. Of course, this is the job of the clinicians, though. I'm a bit at the other end of the picture. I'm the person who liaises with the clinician, with the pathologist, and tries to look at the problem from another perspective. The clinician sees the patient, diagnoses the syndrome, the phenotype, the neuropsychological features of the individual. We are looking more from within the problem. What is say the genetic and then the molecular reason by which the brain reaches degeneration. So in a nutshell, what I do is collecting DNA samples from all of these patients who are seen by clinicians, and within the IFGC, actually, this is a neat approach, because it's a large, huge network where clinicians that actually see patients are, from all over the world. So we're talking from North America to the UK to the EU, continental Europe, to Australia. So it's really a network of professionals who work together. Mm. Everybody does their job, but now it's also not anymore the case of everybody doing their job separately. Mm. We start talking to each other. We start
breaking down the
working
silos.
Together. Yeah. And so once the samples are collected, myself, but other mm. other research groups as well. I mean, this is not the only.
And when you say samples and you're working DNA. With other, are you actually like building a sort of per se a brain bank?
Well, brain bank is something which is developed by an actual brain bank. So those who collect brains of the individuals after they die. Mm-hmm. So this is not necessarily what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So I'm literally working actually with blood and DNA, which is extracted from blood, could also be extracted from the brain, but it is easier to get it from the blood. And the nice thing about the DNA is that it's stable. And there's, although we know that there are changes, there are mutations, these are fairly rare. Mm-hmm. So the DNA of an individual is going to fingerprint that individual since they're born until they die, and that is going from generation to generation. So that's also why you can study the genetics of a disease within families, which is a bit easier, so to speak, because it's more homogeneous sort of sample source. But also, of course, there's patients who don't have a family history and who do not carry variants or mutations in what we now call the known genes for frontotemporal dementia. And that is what we as IFGC are looking at. We're looking at all of those cases out there which neither have really a familial history but do have the disease, nor they carry a known mutation. And so we try to shed light on what's happening there, what the genetic etiology of these individuals. And if you think, these are actually the majority of the people. So if you consider the 100% of FTD patients, there is up to 30% that are so-called familial, which means are related to a specific gene. The remainder 70%, we really don't know where to start. And so this is one of the probably unique features of the IFGC, is really focusing on the unknown in a way.
So can I just ask then, does that mean that there are potentially two types of strains of this type of dementia? Is that too quick to say that?
So the way I would look at it actually is that the disorder is by itself heterogeneous, which means within a spectrum of patients you see different types of syndromes. In fact, we know of the behavioral variant, which is a consequence of the frontal lobes being affected, and that will affect a person's behavior. In fact, that's how it's called. People will lose insight, will lose the capability of problem solving, of rationalizing things, and they will become, especially, again, their behavior will become odd in social situations. So it's really dangerous also in some occasions. The other type of patients within the FTD spectrum are actually having language impairments. That is, I won't go into details there, but basically there's two groups there. So one group of patients called semantic dementia patients have an issue in forming sentences which make sense, which means they speak fluently, but what they are talking about is not entirely clear. Because they're using the meaning of the words, or it's not that they don't know what the word means, but they're putting in words that don't really make sense within the bigger context they're talking about. And the other group is called progressive non-fluent aphasia, and that's an impairment in speaking. So the patient will stop speaking, looking for the word. It's not that they do not know, again, it's not that they do not know the meaning of words, but in this case, just not coming. Mm-hmm. So they will stop every second, third word, yeah, to look for the next to come until it comes. That's why non-fluent. So you see already, it's kind of a broad spectrum. In addition to that, there is, for example, an overlap in in some patients of any of these sort of symptoms that I just described, together with motor neuron issues. That is what is also understood as FTD overlapping with motor neuron disease, and the major example is FTD and ALS overlapping together in the same.
And is that common?
Already FTD is not very common, and ALS is also a sort of rare form of disorder, but once you have one of the two, it can happen in 5% of the cases, for example, that you swing between the two phenotypes while your disease is progressing. So although both are rare, once there is the onset of one of the two disorders, it can happen, but then it will embrace the neurodegenerative process will embrace both sort of spectrums. So having this, keeping this in mind, it's really a broad form of disorder to look at. And when you want to make the connections between these clinical phenotypes with the underlying pathology, which is at the stage when in brain banks you're able to actually look at the brain, not only atrophy patterns, but also what happened, how do these neurons die in these specific brain regions. So what the community is really trying to find is this continuum between what we see at the symptomatic level with the underlying pathology, and then further correlating it with the genetics. But again, all of these features are very heterogeneous, and it is difficult to further categorize within clear lines what goes with what. Does behavioral variant always go with tau pathology and always with tau mutations? That's not really the case. Sometimes you have the first two pieces of the puzzle, but then the third, you don't find any particular specific variant in that gene you would expect it in. And so, for example, again, this is where the IFGC tries to further harmonize the global FTD patient population and to see whether through genetics we can better define the different clinical syndromes in order to find a genetic architecture at the basis of all of these different forms of the disease. Why? Because we know that each type of genetic contribution is informative, and I'm going back to where I started, is informative in the sense of we want to understand what goes wrong in the brain or in the system of an individual that leads to neurodegeneration. So the genes which are known in familial cases, which means that 30%, we're looking at the 70%, is informative to start seeing which molecular process, in other words, cellular processes or pathways within the cell go wrong.
And I guess how their foundations differ.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you want to translate this sort of knowledge into understand how those processes actually are disrupted in all patients. So we're trying to fill this sort of gap. And so we're using genetics, and this is how it started, IFGC, International FTD Genomics Consortium, but it's more developing into a multi-omics consortium. So start looking at transcriptomics, proteomics, and especially also bioinformatics and systems biology, to go beyond the just pure genetics, which is important, but listing up genetic markers or genes is not enough to find out what really happens and what is really the basis, the molecular basis of the disease. It's like looking at the car which stops working, and you need to have an understanding of the engine.
Not just the wheels
or the steering wheel, to be then able to go back and intervene. So we're at that stage. We want to find out how the whole engine in the brain works and which parts of the engine are actually impacted and that they will eventually lead to disease. Also because, for example, what is known as familial frontotemporal dementia is always associated with a particular gene which is considered to dramatically drive the disease. Even these days at the meeting, we're seeing that this is not necessarily exactly the case. For example, families where the same mutation, say in granulin, is identified and it actually segregates within the family. So all of the individuals in the family which also have the disease have that mutation, and the individuals in the family who do not develop symptoms do not have. So it sounds like a clear cut, and it sounds like, well, we found a reason for it. Now, besides understanding the mechanism there, we're still recognizing now that still within the same family, the same mutation, actually the spectrum of the disease is quite broad. What do I mean by that? Some individuals with the same mutation, the same gene, develop the disease at a certain age. Their brother, exactly the same genetic makeup, develops the disease much later and with some additional features. Okay. So we kind of there, in the sense of we're understanding, we're grasping the fact that there is still more. And
it sounds like few commonalities, really. Fewer than what you thought.
It sounds like it, but then again, it's the difference in, and that's why we're exploring the genetics also, and especially of non-familial cases, to find whether there are communal and global genetic factors at the basis of the disease. Then, of course, these major genes are critical in the sense that they probably increase the severity of the disease and increase the pace at which the disease degenerates, etc. Yeah. But what we're looking at two different sort of aspects. So the known genes are like a tsunami, just creates in one day a large amount of a disaster, really, right? Whereas the common architecture of the disease is there. It's like the sea with small waves that will shape the coast, and it will take a bit of a longer time. So we're trying to combine all of this to have a global view of what happens genetically, and from there shedding light on all of the molecular pathways which are impacted, because of, again, going back, the genetic is pretty stable. So you're born with your genetic architecture, and the way that will allow your body to work, it is constitutive, which means your body will always work in that way it's programmed, so to speak. And if there are some defects, which are not major, but still slightly impacting one or two particular pathways, it will take that some amount of time until these pathways not working properly or working differently to reach the level at which the disease then starts. And in fact, if you think this is a disease of the older age, which means something is accumulating throughout the life of an individual until it reaches that point that it just starts as a neurodegenerative progressive disorder, which cannot be reversed. So what we try, again, going back to the IFGC, is a large international group of individuals with different expertise. In fact, again, we're talking about clinicians, we're talking about pathologists, we're talking about geneticists, we're talking about bioinformaticians, who actually are the magicians in the sense of they use all of this data we generated trying to connect the dots. But everyone's contribution is fundamental, because everybody's bringing their bit of expertise to the table. Then, of course, it needs somebody who is passionate. I mean, everybody is passionate, but then everybody's passionate about a side of the work. So then we need people who are passionate about coordinating all of these individuals and include their work within a vision, which is broad, but it's a vision that hopefully makes sense and hopefully will be successful. And why? Why? Because we start with a problem, and we subdivide, so to speak, the job into multiple tasks. But what we really want to do is we want to be able to reach a stage where we, for example, identify measurable biomarkers to early diagnose, to prevent disease. So ideally, something that you could check already in individuals in their 30s, 40s, way before the disease is going to really kick in and there's nothing to be done about it then. Then, so that's one group where we can be effective. Another group where we can be effective is when, unfortunately, the disease has already started, but having biomarkers in order to monitor disease, in order to monitor its progression and to buffer all of the side effects that the disease takes with itself. And the third group is treatment measures. So within those pathways that we aim to identify and the biomarkers we want to find within those pathways, we want to be able in the long run to identify those that we can use for early diagnosis, those that we can use for disease monitoring, and those that we can use for therapy. And all of this really is a global effort for the patient benefit at the different stages of the patient.
And how close are we to pulling that together? You said you've got a consortium working on this.
That is really something you can, it's a good question, but it's difficult to answer. Let me start with an example before I get more into that sort of detail. So Alzheimer's disease is very well known by the scientific community. It's very well known by everyone. By now, everybody knows what Alzheimer's disease is. And if you think, it was first described in the late 1800s in Germany. The first patient, there may have been others, but of course the first patient was recorded is in the late 1800s. So now if you put the years together, we're getting close to 150 years that we're aware of this disease, and you may know we still have no cure. We tend to think we're grasping the disease mechanism, but once some clinical trials targeting some of these pathways that have been highlighted were implemented in patient groups, it didn't really work. So what this means is that we're on the right track, but it's a very complicated issue to tackle. So you think Alzheimer's disease, 150 years, we're still there trying to really figure out what the mechanism is. So FTD can learn a lot from that, and not that people didn't do a good job, is that we can learn from the pitfalls which just happen, and we can apply them to frontotemporal dementia, to any other form of disease, really. It's that we need to really make sure we understand what is happening in order to be able to go and target those processes that are impaired and impacted. And the beauty of the current time is that the technology allows us to do many things at the much faster pace. Not only data generation, but also data analysis, data integration. And that is clearly helpful because, for example, again, that's the difference with Alzheimer's disease. When the first genes were identified in Alzheimer's disease, and they were right genes, it took almost 30 years to develop the functional biology work to try and understand what was happening when those genes were mutated. Now today, we have the wealth of the knowledge that has been created through the years, through, again, genomics, transcriptomics, proteomics, and there is data out there that we can merge now. So for example, rather than having every single gene that is associated with frontotemporal dementia being investigated separately by separate research groups, but really a trial and error type of approach, we now can put them all together and identify pathways, so communal ways by which they exert their effect. And we can do this all computationally. And basically what that means is that we can, probably in a matter of weeks or months, depends on how the pipelines are, the computational pipelines are working, in that much shorter amount of time, we're able to go and then speak to a functional biologist, telling them, look, this is where we think you need to look into. You can really design your hypothesis-driven experiment to test a pathway rather than a single gene, and first understanding what that single gene, which also means the protein, is doing in whatever cellular environment. So really go in there telling them, now you have all of the ingredients, you have the cutlery, you have the oven, this is the kitchen, it's well equipped. Now you're the cook. Put things together, design your menu, and get it done. It's much quicker. Before, it was really people looking for the ingredient and collecting that one piece of ingredient, but missing all of the others. And they would eventually come, but of course, it would take much longer. Now we're at the stage we can at least bring everything to the table with a better rationale at its, you know, at its basis. And then it's up to, again, it's multitasking again, and then it's again taking advantage, but in the nice sense of the word, of people then really have the expertise to finally make the hypothesis become reality and test it, validate it, and then it's where we know we can go further into clinical trials and into identifying real biomarkers for the reasons I already mentioned. Therefore, early diagnosis, disease monitoring, and disease treatment. And this is all really a group work, and it's a service. It's a service to the community, and I think this is the spirit by which we all work. And this is an example. It's bringing now. This is, by the way, a community that over the past 10 years has grown from 150 to 200 to over 600 people. So you see that there is a lot going on. And so we all wish it would be as quick as possible, but we have no control by when we're going to have it. But for sure, everybody's really passionate about this and is really passionate about solving this issue, which is for those who are affected and the family of the people who live with affected individuals is quite tricky, and it's quite demanding physically and mentally.
You've been listening to a podcast interview with Dr. Raphael Ferrari, Alzheimer's Society Junior Research Fellow at the University College London in the UK. Dr. Ferrari spoke on the International FTD Genomics Consortium, an international platform to study and understand frontal temporal lobe dementia, at the 11th Conference for Frontotemporal Dementias held during November 2018 in Sydney, Australia. This podcast is one of a series commissioned by the conference organisers to augment the conference content. The International Society for Frontotemporal Dementias is a non-profit scientific society with a focus on understanding all aspects of frontotemporal dementias. Members include leaders in FTD research around the world, and the society is associated with a large international biannual meeting presenting the latest findings. We welcome new members and offer several levels of membership associated with where you are in your career. Membership includes updates on the latest discoveries in the FTD field, discounted registration at the biannual meeting, and a special journal issue focused on FTD. The science in the field of neurodegenerative disease and frontotemporal dementia in particular is racing ahead, and potential treatments are being developed and tested. We welcome your participation in ISFTD to keep advancing this vibrant field. We look forward to serving you as a new member and helping to push forward the science in this important area. To learn more about ISFTD membership, please visit www.isftd.org.